Greetings and welcome to the 9th episode of the NASCAR and NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. I think we've got two great guests this week. We'll start with Jeff Burton, who is the NBC sports analyst on our daily show, NASCAR America, as well as an analyst in the booth with Rick Allen and Steve Letarte on our Sprint Cup broadcasts. This is a really good discussion with Jeff Burton. We get into Kyle Busch's victory in Martinsville Speedway and the career significance of that for the defending series champion. We have a good philosophical discussion about the relationship between drivers and the media and what it's like now for Jeff now that he's on that other side, that he's part of the media. He, of course, has great perspective having been a driver in NASCAR's Premier Series for the better part of two decades and has some really interesting food for thought about that relationship between drivers and media. We talk about some of the defining moments of Jeff Burton's career and the tough choices he made when he left Roush Fenway Racing to go to Richard Childress Racing in 2004, and then about how he decided to end his career. His last full-time season was in 2013. He would have preferred it would have been in 2014. That was his initial plan, and he's very, very candid. And Jeff's also going to give us a little preview of what we can expect to see in the booth for NBC Sports when we return to broadcasting Sprint Cup races in July at Daytona. Now, Jeff is also the inaugural winner at Texas Motor Speedway in 1997. That track is where the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series is this weekend. So the second guest we have on the podcast today will be Texas Motor Speedway president Eddie Gossage, and we'll get into his story. He's been there since the beginning when that track opened 19 years ago, now beginning its 20th season. The first two seasons were pretty rough on Eddie, and he's very candid and very funny, to be quite honest, about how things went those first 2 years, why it was rough, what he learned, and where the track is now as it enters its 20th season. And again, with a new low downforce package, what we might expect to see on Saturday night in the Sprint Cup race at Texas. We really appreciate you listening, as always, to the podcast. Please rate us or give us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends to subscribe if you like what you hear. And next week, we will continue our NBC Sports Analyst run. We'll have Dale Jarrett scheduled for what I hope will be another insightful edition of the podcast. But for now, again, thanks for listening. And without further ado, here is NBC Sports Analyst Jeff Burton. All right, we're going to get started here and start with the previous weekend, Jeff. Martinsville Speedway. Kyle Busch wins and ticks off another track from the list of ones that he hadn't conquered. All that's left now, Pocono, Charlotte, Kansas. So what I'm curious to know from you, being a student of the sport, you know the history. He's got a championship, but now he's on the verge of doing something that Jeff Gordon didn't do, Jimmy Johnson hasn't done, Tony Stewart hasn't done, win at every track on the circuit. If he doesn't win another championship, and by all rights he probably will, where do you think that puts him in the pantheon if he's able to win at every track on a circuit?
Well, I think the thing that that's very difficult to do because, you know, there's a lot of things that go into racing. It's more than just a driver's skill. There's the ability to have the right pit stop at the right time. There's the ability to not break engines, to all these kind of things that happen. And so when you start narrowing down a racetrack or two racetracks and you need to win on those racetracks to win them all, it becomes very difficult because on a particular night, and now you typically have two chances on these racetracks to win. On one of those two nights or afternoons, everything has to go just right for you to do it. It becomes very difficult to win everywhere because winning these races is very hard. So it would mean a great deal. And I think the thing with Kyle is that, you know, you can't separate from him his accomplishments on Saturdays and Fridays. He's won so many truck races and so many Xfinity races. When you look at what he's won in Cup, he's won a lot, but there's people that won quite a lot more.
Yeah.
But then when you add what he's done in those other series, it's like, wow. I mean, it's you know, years ago we thought, well, nobody wins as many races as Mark Martin's won.
Right.
And he's gone by it and kept digging by it. So, you know, Kyle has done extraordinary things. But it will be difficult for him to win. He's young. That's the thing he has going for him.
Right.
He's very young, but it's going to be difficult to win at every single racetrack.
Yeah. Which one of those do you think gives him the most trouble? I know Kansas hasn't been particularly good for him.
No, he is outwardly spoken of his dislike for Kansas. You know, Charlotte and Pocono, I mean, those are kind of racetracks that I mean, he runs well on all kinds of racetracks. But,
right.
You know, as he's gotten older, you know, the 600 to me is the kind of race that really works well for him because especially with this lower downforce package. I think the groove's going to open up. You're going to have a lot of running up by the wall all over the place, late race restarts. You know, I don't know of any of those tracks that he can't win on for sure.
Hmm. You mentioned the victory total, and somebody, of course, because we're the media, somebody had to ask him after his 35th victory ever. Hey, you know, Pearson, he didn't win his 35th till he was 34. So do you think you can catch Pearson? I'm sure that, you know, that's the type of question that you would always love when we throw that your way. But, right. I mean, I don't know if he gets to 100 in Cup, but it almost seems a certainty he's going to get to 200 across Cup, Xfinity, and Truck, because I think he's like in the 150 or 160 range all three series together. That's not Richard Petty winning 200 Cup races, but where do you think that ranks him if he gets there?
I mean, he's in uncharted territory. I mean, you know, we haven't seen anyone that has won that many races across all the, you know, like there's nothing to compare it to. I mean, that's the thing. Like, he's in an area where no one's been, and that's what makes it so difficult. And, you know, and a lot of people discount his wins in the Xfinity Series because he's driving for Joe Gibbs. Well, other people drive for Joe Gibbs too.
Right.
You know, and you know, he's driving for Kyle Busch Motorsports. Well, guess what? He's not the only one driving a Kyle Busch Motorsports. So, you know, yes, he's driving very, very good equipment, but he's getting more out of that equipment than the other people that are driving it as well, with multiple crew chiefs.
Right. When we came in, or when I came in today, you asked me immediately if I'd heard anything about if Matt Kenseth had said anything after the race, and we know that he and Kyle worked together on restarts at Martinsville, where Kyle would take the outside, Kenseth would let him in on the inside, until that final restart, which initially was 12 to go, then it got changed to 11, and as Kyle explained at post-race, the deal was within 10 laps, it would be every man for himself. But
close enough.
Close.
I think it's smart for teammates to work together like that. I think that makes a lot of sense. But when it comes down to winning time, at that point, it's every man for himself. And if you go back and you watch, and it was interesting. There was a really good battle for the lead, but there were so many battles in the field that it was hard to focus on just the battle for the lead. But if you go back and focus on the battle for the lead when that last caution came out, Matt had caught him. And Matt was putting an extraordinary amount of pressure on him to the point where Matt may win this race. So if you're Kyle Busch, whether he's your teammate or not, you have to look at that and say, do I want to give him an opportunity to start and, you know, getting right behind me when he just exhibited that he's probably faster than me?
Right.
And it's so at some point, you have to be selfish. You have to be about you and your team. And that's what's so hard about teammates, is that teammates get mad at each other because they expect more from each other. But you have to remember, what would you have done?
Right.
If you were the one, you know what I mean? So the reason that I asked that question to you is because I was curious what was said over the radios. You know, what was the conversation? What was Matt's attitude? Because, to be honest, I was more concerned about Matt's mental well-being. Because if you go back and you go back into last year, and then you follow his this year, my goodness. I mean, they can put their shoes on, but they can't tie them. Right. I mean, you know, they just can't seem to finish a race off. And I mean, I've talked to him about it, and he was very frustrated after Daytona, and he's very frustrated after another race that had problems. But, you know, and you say to yourself, you keep saying to yourself, we're running good. As long as we're running good, it's going to work out. But at some point, it's like, good Lord, what do we got to do to change this? Because they finished 15th.
Right.
And if you go back, you know, Matt never ran well at Martinsville. I mean, self-proclaimed, he was awful at Martinsville and the road courses, right? But since he's joined Joe Gibbs, he's been really good at road courses and Martinsville. And now he has a shot to win the race. And they finished 15th. And on top of that, I think Matt could step back and say, you know, I understand what Kyle's situation, but at the same time, your teammate didn't work with you.
Right.
On top of everything else that has happened, you know, at some point, the water boils over the pot.
This was exactly my next question to you. And two things here. One, I should say, Kenseth did give a brief quote to Toyota that didn't really talk about the final restart.
But
typical Kenseth, classy, hey, it didn't work out. I just couldn't hold these guys off at the end, and that's the way it went.
Yep.
That's what we would expect, of course, you knowing him as well as anybody, more so than me, about Matt. The other thing is I heard Joe Gibbs in Victory Lane, overheard him talking to somebody, and as much as he was happy for Kyle, you could sense that he was like, man, I'm really happy for Kyle, but oh my God, Matt. I mean, three times this year he might have had the fastest car, and you're right. It's not just that they're not closing it out. It's 15th at Martinsville with a top five car.
Right.
Daytona,
right.
They finished what, 17th when they could have won, and that's got to eat at you a little bit, right?
That you're well, just no giving question. Away points. And listen, everybody focuses just on wins because that's what we've been taught. We've been told if you win races, you're in the chase. Points still matter, and it's people are going to make this chase by getting in by points. And if you start adding up all the races and all the positions that Matt and his team have given up late in races, it's a lot of positions. It's a lot of points. And Matt and his team, they believe they can win, okay? But they're also smart enough to know that they need to gain points. And they're also, you get to the point, and what my concern for that team is you get to the point where you have to go to the racetrack and say, we just need to finish 10th. You know, and you tend to, when you're trying to get things back in order, you tend to overcompensate a little bit.
Right.
Either you try too hard or you settle for a finish that really isn't good enough, but for you at that moment, it is. And either way isn't the attitude you want going to the racetrack. You want to go to the racetrack with the right attitude, with the right goal, with the right mindset. But when it starts piling up on you, it's hard to get lined up.
Is Kenseth the right driver to go through this because he is so even-keeled and able to just handle anything that's thrown at him?
Yeah, but, you know, Matt's one of those guys he never forgets.
Yeah.
You know, and
how many times do you think he's rewatched Daytona?
Oh, he relives stuff, and but he does have a good perspective. Like, he and I were having a conversation a few weeks ago about a particular driver in another series, and he didn't even know who that was. And I'm like, how do you not know who that is? And he's like, I race and then I play with my kids. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
he's gotten to the point in his life where he knows there's something bigger than racing. And some people say that's a bad thing. It's a good thing for a motivated, driven driver. Like that's why I think Kyle Busch is better today than he was a year ago, because he had everything that he thought mattered to him taken away. And when he wrecked at Daytona, you know, he saw the evil side. He saw, you know, he saw what can be there. And so getting that perspective for a guy like Matt and a guy like Kyle that are driven, that want to win, that balances their life out a little bit. That puts them, that gives them some perspective. And I think that's healthy for that kind of driver. Now, a driver that already is thinking about, you know, spending time, doesn't want to be at a test, those kind of, that guy, you know, no, that it's bad for him. But for a guy like Matt and like Kyle, I think that perspective helps him.
Yeah. Well, we did hear from Kenseth then after the Martinsville race. I wanted to ask you about Kyle, who we didn't hear from after an Xfinity race recently at Fontana. You were always really good with the media, with talking with us, and now you're a member of the media, and I think that you get it as well as anybody. When you see a driver who has a bad finish decide that he's not going to meet with the media, what's your take on that? Do they always have an obligation to speak with us, or should it be allowed or forgiven that when they don't want to, that they don't have to?
Well, I think that first of all, I think that by far the majority of the time, the driver should stop and take time. And it's not about the media. It's about the fans.
Right.
The way the fans get the information, the way what makes our sport great is the passion. And when the driver leaves without comment, then either he's really mad and doesn't want to talk, but you don't know, right? Like, so it's okay to say, I'm pissed off. It's okay to say, you know what? I think that sucks. It's okay to say NASCAR screwed up. It's okay to say that guy wrecked me. Those things are okay.
Right.
And I think that drivers sometimes have been taught not to say anything bad. It's okay to say something bad. It's how you say it. It's okay to question NASCAR. It's okay to say that guy wrecked me. All those things are fine. And you're going to say it to that driver anyway. You're going to say it to NASCAR anyway. I mean, I don't think you say it in a disparaging way. I don't think you say it in an ugly way. But the fans paid their money. The fans invested 3.5 hours to watch the race. The fans invest time to listen to radio and watch TV shows and read articles. The competitors owe it to those fans to let them know how they feel.
Mm-hmm. You're now on the other side again with you're not on the other side. You've transferred to the other side. You're a media member now.
Is this good or bad?
Oh, that was my question. Because I know
I gained a lot of weight.
That's important, as you've been telling us over the years.
Yes. I got it back off now, though. I had to get away from y'all for a little while.
That's good.
I got my weight back off.
I found that running helps. Yeah. I don't know if you.
I had to quit eating. That was my first step.
Okay. Then definitely don't touch any media center food or anything they serve in any of the suites. But we actually have roped you into helping us a few times, which I won't go into details, but we are eternally grateful for that because we put you in the position of essentially being a reporter a little bit and being a media member and helping us, as you said, get the facts right and vet stories. What's it? And you're doing some interviewing, I know, on NASCAR America, you and Letarte and DJ, when we have drivers in. What's it been like, that whole experience of now being on the other side?
Well, you know, fortunately, I had a transition. You know, I think what Jeff Gordon's doing this year is really difficult. It would have been hard for me to get out of the car in November and then be in the booth in February. That would have been hard. I was able to be out of the car, run a few races for MWR, and then fill in for Tony. And then while I was doing that, I was doing NASCAR America and kind of getting up to speed. And then last year, it was just about TV, and it was just about NASCAR America. So I've had this transition into it, and it's I'm glad I had that time. I mean, I'm glad I had the time to kind of walk into it. I didn't have to jump head first into it, and I've enjoyed it. It's the only thing to me that's been a little difficult is, you know, when you say something, the drivers say they don't watch, right?
They watch every minute of every race.
They do when you say something. I can tell you that they disagree with. But that's what I signed up for. I knew that.
Yeah.
And I think staying involved was easy for me last year because I was still racing, you know, and people, they looked at me as a race car driver, but I think the longer you're not a race car driver, the more they look at you as a member of the media.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they start to protect just a little bit. But the people that I know, I mean, they'll tell me things and say, hey, look, you know, don't say this. Right. But, you know, they'll tell me the whole story. The people that I don't know, I have to learn how to bridge that gap, you know, that relationship. When you raced, like, to be honest with you, I didn't really care if that guy that I was racing with liked me or not. I wanted him to respect me, but we didn't have to go to dinner, right? Like, I wanted him to respect me on the racetrack, but if he didn't want to talk to me, that's okay. Like, that's fine, you know. But now I want him to talk to me. You know, I want that relationship. So, getting to know the people that I don't really know, getting to know the younger drivers, to me, finding a way to do that, that's really been the hardest part of the transition. I have a lot of drivers tell me, you know, they were depressed, that they had trouble, you know, not racing anymore. I haven't had that. I have rolled right into it, but I had transition time to roll into it.
Yeah, yeah, you did. The couple of races you ran in 2014 while you were moving into the NASCAR America role before full time in 2015.
Yeah.
Do you stay in the motorhome lot then? You talk about maintaining those relationships.
Yeah, so I think it's important. I think it's important to stay at the racetrack some. I think it's important to stay in the hotel some. So that's what I do. I kind of mix it up. You know, I like to be number one. I like the racetrack. I like being at the racetrack. And you know, I'm comfortable there. I know everyone there. So I like being there. Number one. I think more happens in the motorhome lot than people realize. You know, it's there. That is a great place to spend time with people. And I'm not talking about sitting down with someone doing an interview. I'm just talking about sitting outside the motorhome having a beer with somebody.
Right.
Right. Just what, you know, that kind of thing. Just to get to know people. And that's, you're not going to do that in the garage. That's not happening in the garage. But on a Friday night at Texas Motor Speedway, you could sit down with somebody and talk about football. You know, talk about whatever. You don't have to even talk about racing, just to get to know people.
You obviously know the current establishment, as it may be, you know, Kenseth, Jimmy Johnson, Tony Stewart. guys who have been around, Dale Earnhardt Jr., Kevin Harvick, but there's a younger guard, and generationally, another generation, really, Kyle Larson, Ryan Blaney, Austin Dillon. I know you know a guy like Dillon, but these other guys, like Larson and Blaney, do you...
Well, some of them I know because I watched them racing.
True.
Before other people knew who they were. You know, like, I watched Blaney race when he was 13 years old. You know, or 13, 14 in that range. I've watched Chase Elliott race before he was Chase Elliott. So some of these guys I know from local short tracks and from quarter midget racing or bandolero racing, whatever. So some of those guys I already know. There are some of them I don't. You know, there's a lot of these younger drivers that are coming up that are in the truck series today that haven't gotten a cup yet that – I've been watching race for 2 or 3 years. Like, I know them really well. I know some of them better than I know, say, like a Kyle Larson. Because of my son's racing, I've been at a lot of the same racetracks that a lot of these younger guys have been at. And Harrison started younger than they were, but then, you know, Harrison hangs out with Jeb sometimes. Well, Jeb hangs out with all those guys, so I got to get Harrison because he's not supposed to be out that late, right? And so I know some of them because they've got my kid in trouble a few times.
So the generation gap doesn't really matter because you're the dad who has dealt with them.
Well, they think I'm old. I mean, they think I'm old for sure. But.
Nice. You mentioned about making that transition. I know you've discussed this before, probably 3 years ago or so when you first made the announcement you were going to move to NBC Sports. But how do you know? How did you know? Because a lot of drivers wrestle with this.
I didn't. You know, the way the whole thing worked to where I was needing to look at what my other opportunities were was just the way things happened at RCR. It just everything presented itself. You know, the Ryan Newman, they had a driver there that was plenty capable of coming in. They had funding to make the program whole. There were a lot of things. At the same time, I had an opportunity to start with NBC and do NASCAR America. Everything just kind of presented itself. It wasn't like I said, okay, it's time. Everything just happened. And when all the evidence started piling up, then it was like, I mean, I Sam Flood and I had a conversation, and he's like, can you do stuff in 2000 and – I'll get my years confused now. Can you do stuff in 2014? And I'm like, no. You know, because to be honest with you, that was going to be my last full year. The original plan was for 2014. I was going to say in the spring of 2014, hey, or sometime, this is my last year. That I had already told Richard Childress, I had told Caterpillar, like 2014, I'm sorry, 2014. That was going to be it.
Right.
And Caterpillar knew it. Richard Childress knew it. My wife knew it. I hadn't told anybody else, but that was the plan. And that got moved forward by a year.
Yeah.
Some of that I greatly regret. Some of that I had a plan and I wanted it all to happen the way I wanted it to happen. I wasn't looking for a farewell tour.
No,
I wasn't looking for that crap. I was just wanting to.
You wanted to go out on your own terms, essentially.
Yeah, I wanted to go out on my own terms, and I wanted to go. I wanted to go and feel what it was like knowing you were at Martinsville for the last time, right? Like,
yeah.
And because I just you lose the appreciation of things, you know. But when you go back and you're like, I mean, I'll never forget. I you know, one of the things in my career that stands out was. It was Mark Martin's last race at Homestead. And on that same day, it was potentially my last race, but I didn't know, you know. And I went down before the race to see him. And I mean, I started crying.
Wow.
And walking back to my car, I mean, I couldn't help it. I mean, you know, I knew how hard he had worked. I knew the things we had done together. I didn't know what was happening with me, you know what I mean? And it was... I wanted to experience what he was experiencing, you know, saying, hey, okay, this is my, you know, I wanted to experience that. But having said that, I'm not complaining. Like, in a perfect world, that's how it would have laid out. But the way everything happened, and I'm a pretty analytical, everything just made sense to do it when it happened. It just made more sense.
Right.
Even though emotionally, it wasn't what I wanted. In best case for everybody, it was the right thing to do. It helped Richard Childress Racing. It helped me get into the flow with NBC. I think it helped NBC because, you know, now they had a guy that had time to talk about stuff that I wouldn't have had time to talk about. Steve didn't have time to talk about it because he was doing his thing. So it just made sense to do it at that time.
But your reasoning makes perfect sense as well for wanting to do it on your own terms and have that feeling, because I saw it last year. Everybody saw it with Jeff Gordon, where he downplayed the farewell tour. He wasn't doing the, you know, present a rocking chair to me at every racetrack, but he did embrace it, and you could tell that he was appreciative in probably a different way than if he hadn't known.
Yeah, and hear this too. There were some places that I could still win on.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew, and I think my team would tell you too, that like I could still win at New Hampshire. I could still win at Martinsville. I could still win at Phoenix. I could win at Charlotte. There were some racetracks that for some reason I got to where I couldn't. I don't know, to this day, I don't know why, that I facts are facts, right? I wasn't able to win on for whatever reason. And I don't know why. But there are some other racetracks that I know I could have. And I felt, in my heart, I felt that 31 team was going to be so much better than it was the year before, because the year before, it was Luke's first year back.
Right.
You know, and
you were right, because they were that much better in 14 versus 13. Right.
There was a lot of things that were moving that I'm like, we've paid the price.
Yeah.
We've laid the down payment down. Let's cash a check, you
right,
know?
Right.
And I thought that was going to be the year that we were going to be able to cash a check.
That's funny, because I remember vividly, I used to work, for those who don't know, I used to work for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. So at the time I was a Virginia guy and I was covering a Virginia driver. And I remember you distinctly saying that about when you left Roush Fenway to go to Richard Childress Racing, and Carl Edwards stepped into what was then the 99 team. And you said, I knew this is a team that's about to get good.
Yeah, and you can ask Carl today. I told Carl.
Yeah.
Like, I called Carl and I said, look, I think I called him before Jack Roush called him.
Yeah.
And I said, look, this thing's going to go down. And, like, this is a good race team. This, I know we haven't performed, but if you look at what we've done the last month, and if you look at what has happened to get us to where we are today, you're going to be stepping into a really good race team. And that's the same thing I knew about the 31. When most teams, okay, the 48 has defied logic, but most teams in football, basketball, baseball, and in racing, they go through periods where they're rebuilding, where they're getting better, where they're not as good as they need to be. And so then they make changes. The good organizations make changes, and then they get better. And that's what was happening in both of those situations. Like, I knew it was getting better. There was no doubt in my mind it was getting better. The question is, can you wait long enough?
Right.
You know, can the sponsors hold out? Will the owner hold out? And that's what happens with so many young drivers, is you go and you have a few bad years, and they're like, well, you know, they don't have patience anymore.
Right.
If you just hold out, you know what I mean? You got to cut at some point.
Right.
But those are difficult decisions.
So then what's it like for you to watch, stepping away from the 31 the next year, Ryan Newman finishes second in the championship to Kevin Harvick in 2014. Carl Edwards in 2005 has this breakout year. I think he won six times and finishes second in points as well.
So I'm sitting in my office at my house with Russell Branham and my wife, and I've just hung up the phone with Richard Childress. And now I've got to make a call. What do I do? Do I call Jeff Smith at Roush Racing and say I'm not coming back?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I call Richard Childress and say I'm going to stay at Roush? Okay. And I looked at both of them and I said, I want to tell y'all right now that we're going to get our ass handed to us next year.
Jeez.
If the two of you won't stay off my ass, as we are getting beat to death next year, I'm not going to do this, because that's what's going to happen. It is going to take a year, 18 months to get the program at RCR, at least that long, turned around. And I've been telling you guys, I know y'all been complaining because we're running like crap and I haven't been happy, but I am telling you, they are going to stomp us in the ground. And don't Yikes. Come to me in June. Yep. I don't want to hear it. I'm doing this, and I'm fully committed, and I'm going to ignore what the 99 does. I'm going to be happy for some of them, right, when they do well, because I've been in the battle with them. But don't look at me after a race and say we made the wrong decision. If I make this decision, you got to all be fully 100% behind me. They both said, yes, I'm fully behind you. And then within 2 weeks, they both backed out on me. But they're both like, "Oh, you sure we did the right thing?" And I'm like, "I told you, don't say it." So, but ultimately, with the 31 car, we started right. beating the 99. You know, right. You look at what we did. We put all those cars in a chase. I mean, 3 years in a row, we put all three RCR cars in a chase. And the 1 year we didn't prior to that, Clint Boyer was a rookie and Gil Martin was a rookie. You know, it was their first year together.
Right, right, right.
And ultimately, we did really, really good. But you had to go through those pains. And that's the way it was at Childress. Like, the only thing about Childress is that from the competitor in me, and I don't mean this, I wanted the 31 to do well, okay? The same way I wanted the 99 to do well. Okay, I didn't want them to do better than me. But now the 31 was doing it, and I couldn't do anything mm-hmm. to say, you guys did good, but I did better, right? Like, now I was just a spectator.
Yeah.
But that's what's really hard about business or sports or anything. You have to put your ego aside. You have to know in your heart what your shortcomings are and what your strengths are. And if you try to compare every single everything, you will drive yourself crazy.
Right.
And I was proud of my career. There's certainly some things I was disappointed about as well. But when I walked away from the 31, it wasn't it was different, because when I went to the 31, I knew we were building something. When I went and left the 31, that meant now I'm building the next phase of my career.
That was the end of a chapter.
Right? Right. Yeah. I was getting really close to closing that chapter. Yeah. And that was a difficult scenario.
Well, your time frame was right on with going to Childress. You went there midway through the 2004 season. And then in 06, you make the chase. And the 99, meanwhile, doesn't. You make the chase, and you have this really good year, really great comeback season. I think win for the first time in 8 or 9 years.
It was a while.
It was a while, and you led the points for a while during the chase. Was that your best opportunity, you think, to win a championship? Was it that season?
That's the one that hurts the most. That's the one that I'd be 100% honest, I hadn't gotten over that yet.
Wow.
Because we went to Martinsville with a pretty good lead. And we broke a motor. And, I mean, it's only like four races left or something. Mm-hmm. And we weren't point racing our way into it. I mean, we'd won a race. We were running really well.
Won Dover. I think you led a good part of Charlotte.
Yeah.
Had Jimmy on the ropes after the way they opened that chase. Yeah.
And we went to Martinsville and broke a motor. And left there third in points. Still feeling like, okay, we're okay. And then went the next week and blew a right front tire. And, you know, there were some years at Roush. There was a couple of years at Roush. Like the year I finished third, you go back and look at the number of times we broke. Like that was, and, you know, to be honest with you, same with Mark Martin. You look at the years, look at the number of times Mark broke, had mechanical issues. Those 2 years are years that I wish I had back. And because, you know, it was right there, but in no way am I saying that I feel like I'm a victim, you know what I mean? Because there mm-hmm. were things that I could have done in races that would have helped us as well. But those 2 years, especially the one at RCR, I mean, I honestly, that kind of, for whatever reason, that kind of sucked the life out of us. Like, we never, after that year, it never came back. Mm-hmm. I will say, when Todd Barrier was my crew chief, my God, were we fast. I mean, we were stupid fast and couldn't win a race. You know, we'd have a stupid pit stop, or we'd have I'd do something stupid, or we'd have a bad pit call, or we couldn't win a damn race. I mean, we had a great year, but could not win a race. And that was a frustrating year as well.
Yeah. So you transition, as you said, though, into the next chapter. And I know you have a competitive side, but I've seen that competitive side still a little bit on the NASCAR America side, because I know you've been a little bit more involved with the show this year. We've seen you a little bit more on the program, and I was on a call where you almost sounded obviously I was never in your team meetings, but I may have heard like the pep talk Jeff Burton side, like of kind of bringing everybody together and like, hey, let's think about ways we can do things better and make the show better. Are there things you take from that competitive side that you use on the TV side?
I am who I am because of the experience that I had. And most of my experiences have been around motorsports. And so right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, I am the person I am because of what I've been around. And obviously I've tried to take the good and use that and try to learn from the bad, because there's been a lot of bad I've been around too. But I am a very competitive person. I want everybody on our team to be competitive people. You know what I mean? I can't, and this no disrespect to anybody, but I want us to have the best TV show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want us to have the best TV broadcast. And that in no way means that I want someone, you know, I want our competitor, or I don't even know if we call him a competitor, that we want our the people that do the first half of the year to do poorly. I want them to be great. I want their broadcast to be great, because guess what? I watch it too. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I just want us to be better.
Yeah.
and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No.
I think they want the same thing. I mean, that's good. That if they want to be better than us and we want to be better than them, then the winners are the fans, right? I mean, that's ultimately the way it is. So, I mean, I like competition. I think competition brings out the best in people. I also think it brings out the worst in people. And you have to have a set of values and morals that you're not going to change, you know, when it's competitive, because it's easy to not do the right thing. But ultimately, I think competition is good for us.
July is still a ways away, but have you started talking or thinking about like what we might see that might be different in the booth this year, what you want to do that's different?
Yeah, I think the thing that we've talked a lot about but maybe not done as well as we should have is, you know, it's supposed to be fun. And you know, when you're watching a race, it's just about you and a bunch of buddies sitting around watching a race, right? And that's how the broadcast should come out. It should be, you know, I know part of it has to be formal and we got to wear ties and I get that. but you know, it's fun, right?
Yeah.
Like let's don't worry about saying the perfect thing and all that. Let's just have fun. Let's have a good time. Bring the information to the fans. Let fans know something that they may not have known. You know, and have a good time. I mean, if we did have a good time. Like, I had a great time last year. Last year was one of the most fun times I've had since I started traveling racing. And that's saying a lot, because I've been traveling racing for a really long time. So I had a great time last year. We had a good group of people. Everybody's fun to be around. You know, it is a really fun group of people, and I enjoyed it. But I think that in our second year, I think we can be more relaxed. I think, you know, Steve and I both, you know, we can relax a little more. We know what's going to happen. We know how it works. I think we can relax a little more, and I think that'll come through in a better broadcast.
Yeah,
Rick's done it forever. You know,
he's
relaxed anyway, but I think Steve and I can relax a little more.
Just come naturally from being year two.
Yeah, I think when we first started, we felt like we had to do everything right. Okay, and that's good. But at the same time, we're not curing world hunger. You know, we're talking about sports, right?
Right.
And we have to keep a perspective of, don't get me wrong, we have to work hard and we have to do it, you know what I mean? But at the same time, I think it's important just to remember, this is fun.
Right.
We're supposed to be having fun.
Right. I hope I'm not spilling the beans here, but I know that I think you're going to have a two-seater car this year for the drive.
Yeah,
rounds.
But man, I'm not. I hear you're the first rider.
That's what I was worried about. I was wondering if you have any plan for that.
You know what? We haven't. I don't know who. I don't know how they've determined who's going to ride with me.
Yes.
I do know that when that was we discussed that. I think Steve said he wasn't. But I don't know how they determine who's going to ride. But that's, you know, that's a I'll be perfectly honest with you. When they said, look, we're going to do this ride around car last year, and I kind of went, oh, what are we going to do? I don't want to do that. Like, why are we going to do that?
Yeah.
But then after 2 weeks of doing it, I started getting all these responses with social media about, wow, I'm really glad you're doing that, because we've done it differently than it's been done in the past. You know what I mean? Like, right. We don't just get in the car and go around the car. We don't get in the car and go around the track fast. Like, we don't need to do that. You can see that on Sunday, right? We don't need to do that. What we do is, like, we'll stop on the racetrack and show the fans a perspective they can't see unless they're in a car. We'll do some things like that. We show them, you know, pit road, how pit road works, and because pit road's so different from one racetrack to the other, there's some things we do differently. We just don't get in the car and say, we're in turn one, and it's really fast, and it's bumpy right here. Like, we can see that, all right? We kind of try to break the specifics of each racetrack down, and the fans seem to really like it.
Yeah, no doubt. And, of course, all of that will come July, but I want to wrap up by talking about a track we'll be going to November with NBC, but this weekend, of course, our partner Fox Sports will have the Texas race. Texas, as we talked about your career, this has been a very important track. First win there when it opened in 97, when it opened in a very memorable sort of way. And you won again there 10 years later. Oh, my gosh. I was not there that day, but oh, have I heard the stories. What do you think we're going to see here Saturday night with low downforce package?
First of all, you know, the fact that the racetrack is old, 20 years old or whatever it is, but the asphalt is old and slick and it's rough. I think that's good stuff. I think that, especially with this low downforce package, I think we're going to see grooves all over the racetrack. Well, that's one thing we've seen with this package is that it's widened the grooves out. It's made it where you can run in more places, and I think that's a good thing, especially at a place like Texas. So we're going to see people running on the white line. We're going to see them running against the wall. To me, the mile-and-a-half races have been better this year. You know, it's been more competitive. There's been a lot more passing, and I think we'll continue to see that.
You mentioned the age of the pavement. Is Texas, I mean, it hasn't been paved since it opened, 19 years ago, but...
It's been paved because it's been reconfigured.
You're right.
Remember the shut up and drive t-shirts they printed?
There was that little thing that happened in the first race where I think everybody crashed but you, which is how you went. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously.
My trophy is still the same.
I think like 18 cars crashed on lap one of that first race.
It was
kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, you more than earned that win. Not the point. Of course, the point is that like it's always been a tough track and they haven't changed it too much since 98. Is it like Atlanta though? I mean,
nothing.
It's okay.
Listen, when they built that racetrack, they said we took a blueprint of Charlotte and we built another Charlotte. Well, somebody doesn't know how to draw because it not even close. I mean, it was so far apart. And thank God,
right?
Like you're gonna build a mile and a half track like somewhere else? Don't do that. I mean, build something different. And I know that the racetracks, you know, I know Atlanta and Charlotte, and I mean, I know they look the same, but they're nowhere near the same. They're the turns one and two at Texas are unique to itself. The entrance to turn one, the way you have to get in the corner, and the way the banking transitions from the straightaway to the corner is the strangest thing in the world. Then if you look at Texas, like if you're going down the back straightaway at Texas, and then you look at how the banking increases, it does it really, really late into the corner. That makes turn three really, really difficult. And I'm telling you, they will be – with the low downforce package, getting into turn three is going to be really, really important because it's the most important part of that racetrack. If you overdrive turn three at all in Texas, then you miss your marks and now you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's going to become even harder with the low downforce package. And what's interesting about Texas – it used to be that the exit of turn two was really, really difficult. Like, there was no grip there. The wall would come up quick. And turn four, you just get it on the gas and go. They flopped. Now, turn four is the hard corner, and turn two is the easy corner. Now, how do you make sense of that? That makes no sense to me whatsoever. I can remember the first 2 years after it kind of flipped, and like, I'm like, man, we're great in turn two, and they're just driving away from me. I'm like, I don't understand. It's never been this good in turn two. So, the track, where you have to be good, has changed on the racetrack.
And even though it's an abrasive surface, it's not like Atlanta in terms of the tire wear. It doesn't quite wear the same way it does.
It doesn't wear as much as Atlanta, but you'll want tires. I mean, when the caution comes out, you're gonna stop with tires on for sure.
Yeah. Who do you like Saturday night? Anybody in particular?
You know, this year has been. I have yet to get a rhythm of who I think is. You know, you can always depend on. I mean, the four car, without a doubt. You can't count Kyle out. You know, he's on a roll. I mean, at some point, Kenseth is going to break through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at some point, he's going to break through. I mean, I know his year has been just horrible, but at some point it's going to break through. And I think when he does break through, there could be a lot of wins.
Right. I think we've completed the circle and gotten back to Matt Kenseth. So I think at this point we will wrap it up. I really appreciate your time, Jeff.
Yeah, man,
thanks for coming
you.
On here. We appreciate Jeff Burton's time very much. Very insightful interview. Unfortunately, because I am not always the most aware of reporters and tend to be oblivious, I neglected to mention that Jeff Burton is being inducted into the Texas Motorsports Hall of Fame this coming week on April 7th, the Thursday before this race. He, of course, was the first two-time winner at that racetrack. And he, of course, Jeff mentioned to me, hey, I'm going to Texas this week. And I neglected to follow up because I was so, at that point, I think, concerned about the levels of his voice. So while we're talking about Texas Motor Speedway and history and the first winner there, Jeff Burton, we're going to bring on the president of Texas Motor Speedway, who has been there since the beginning in 1997, and that is Eddie Gossage. Eddie, thanks for joining us.
You bet. My pleasure, Nate. Glad to be with you and glad to be following up Jeff Burton, one of the obviously most historic and important drivers in this track's history.
He won the first race there in 1997. He won again in 2007, becoming the first two-time winner there. And as you know, Eddie, this is the track's 20th season. I know there's a lot of celebration and attention around that. So let's start there. In your 20 seasons there, you know, what have you seen? What's been the biggest change? You know, how do you look at how the track is celebrating 20 years?
Well, it's amazing if you do anything long enough and how things, you know, kind of come together. But I hear all the time about from the drivers, man, that's just such a fun racetrack. You know, the asphalt is worn out, which is, you know, contrary to popular opinion, that's a compliment from drivers. And you contrast that to the opening of this place, where obviously it was brand new asphalt, and there were other issues that, you know, I don't know anybody that said a good thing about the place. and that was hardly, I appreciate you and all the other reporters that continue to bring up the early years, because I spent tens of thousands of dollars in therapy trying to forget it. It was a brand new racetrack. The drivers didn't care for the transitions from the straightaway onto and off of the banking. And on the very first lap, in the very first turn, there was a huge crash. And to this day, when I bring it up to Darrell Waltrip, that he started it, that he was in the outside line and tried to get down to the bottom of the turn, where there wasn't a hole for Darrell to get to, that he started a crash, and that's when he started screaming about the Alamo and all kinds of things. He honestly went on TV after the crash, went on about the Alamo for a little bit. It was not at all the way you want to start. We also had tremendous amounts of rain on Thursday and Friday morning, and the parking lots here weren't complete. So we had to quickly, and I mean, in one day we set up a park and ride program with buses from every place we could rent them from, and had bussed in fans because you simply couldn't park here. We bussed in about 300,000 people over the course of Saturday and Sunday for the what's now Xfinity and now Sprint Cup races, and you know, it was not pretty at all, but it was, everybody was in their seat and everybody got home, and it wasn't an artistic success, but it was an amazing success, because, you know, there were 194,000 people. I mean, there wasn't a seat or a ticket to find anywhere, and they were hanging from the rafters, and you wind up with Jeff Burton winning his very first race. And I wasn't even sure which Burton it was when he drove into victory lane, because I had been so preoccupied with other things. So
couldn't remember if Ward was in that first lap crash or not.
I don't know. But I do know that it was, you know, first time I've been president of a racetrack, I'm presenting a trophy in victory lane for the first time, and they hand me the microphone, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, Ward or Jeff? Jeff or Ward? Yeah, I'm going to say the wrong one, whichever it is. And so I just tried to talk and talk and talk, so I could, you know, hopefully it would hit me. And I'm looking all over Jeff's uniform. There's nothing there. His name is not on it anywhere. He's probably the only driver in the field. And finally, Jeff I mean, here's a guy with his first win, but he has the presence of mind to drop his shoulder so I could read it off the top of the car. And so it was an interesting little victory lane, and Jeff was incredibly gracious and kind and professional. Although rumor has it, he tells it a little bit differently, but rumor has it that later that night he went back to victory lane, climbed the fence, which had been locked around victory lane, and went in with a screwdriver, and the floor, ground in victory lane, and I think you've seen them, Nate, is made of these Texas pavers that kind of fit together.
Yes. Yeah, love it.
He took a screwdriver and pried one out and took it with him.
Huh.
So he got a big check and stole a paver from the speedway.
Well, that's certainly a great story, and it was, despite some of the incidents that occurred that day. Again, many of which weren't your doing, in terms of you can't control the weather, you can't control the parking lots. I think on balance, when people look back at that race, they think, you know, that was quite a memorable beginning in many ways. And I don't think people look at it necessarily in a completely negative light. Like you said, there are a lot of good things that came out of it. But I won't focus too much on that race. How about the second race? Because I know the second race didn't exactly go completely according to plan. Maybe from a fan perspective it did. And I think you got people in and out of there a lot more efficiently. But in terms of the racing, I know there were still some misgivings from drivers. What do you remember about the second race?
Well, firstly, you know, we did fix our parking lots because, you know, this part of North Texas is flat. So we went in and did some grading so there was some slope and ditches and whatnot so it would drain better. But we also brought in large stone aggregate rock and covered the entire 1,500 acres, which to my knowledge may be the biggest property a speedway has. You know, all our parking is on it, et cetera. We grew grass back up over it, so it looks nice and pretty, and we added some additional paved parking. We now have more parking here than Walt Disney World has, paved parking than Walt Disney World, but we also park on grass, on turf. But the truth is right underneath that is rock, so if we ever got, you know, had wet issues again, you could park your car, get in and out, and we don't have any issues like that any longer. But the enduring memory is just personally for me is my father. This was 1998, and my father, who knows nothing about auto racing, was here, and there were some weepers. We sit in roads all over the country. Just little wet spots that come up out of the ground, and there were weepers in turn one, and drivers were crashing, and so they stopped qualifying, as a matter of fact. And I went down there in turn one, standing on the racetrack, and I'm talking to Rusty Wallace and Mark Martin and Ernie Irvin and a couple of other, you know, greats, and we're looking at this, and it's, you know, Mark even had a tissue paper, a Kleenex, and he was dabbing one of these wet spots, and it didn't dampen his Kleenex, but it was enough to cause the car to lose adhesion. And we're sitting there shaking our head, and Mike Elton, NASCAR president, is there, and there are blowers, you know, the big heat blowers that use to dry the track, and you know, so to communicate, you're really yelling back and forth, but nobody was, you know, having harsh words. It didn't look that way. It looked like we're yelling at each other. We're yelling to be heard, and we decided that we should stop and you know, not start based on points, not continue to qualify, because we had to figure out what we could do to get this water to go away. And I look up, and there's my dad standing on the end of pit road. And again, he has no reference. And we're walking back down towards the entrance or exit of pit road, me and these drivers, and my dad stands there, 70-some-odd years old, and says, "Son, you need a hand with these fellas?" and he was ready to fight them all. So I threw my arm around and said, "Now, Dad, come on with me. Everything's fine." and so I don't know that any of them even got it, but I got it. He was ready to fight for his son, and God bless him for it. And he passed away a little bit later that year with cancer, but that day he was ready to fight. And so That's my memory.
Yeah,
it really, really was. It's kind of a mixed thing. One of those funny little things that you think about later. But you know, we had to stop, and overnight we worked on these spots. It had been rainy, just a really, really wet spring, and we went in, and there are ways to address it. We did. We were able to race on Sunday just fine, but we went back in after that, took up all the asphalt, and installed a drainage system underneath the entire speedway. So it really doesn't pose a problem any longer, but those first 2 years were really, really tough.
I bet. And of course, no one has forgotten the Shut Up and Race t-shirts in year two that also
made
some headlines. But like you said, it all worked out, Eddie. And what I'm curious about is, you mentioned how abrasive that track is, and I think it's up there. Maybe it's not quite at the Atlanta Motor Speedway level, but it certainly has meant that tires wear a lot more there, and I think teams and drivers and fans, media, we all like that when you have that kind of tire wear. What have you, when you look at the track, have you given any thought to having to repave at some point?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. And you know, it's funny, a worn-out racetrack is great, but then all of a sudden, it's no longer great. And, you know, we're not there, but it just, like, from one day to the next, drivers will tell you, oh, you got to repave it now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, 3 days ago, you said it was the greatest surface in racing, you know, and so you don't know when that time will come, but right. We'll deal with that when the drivers tell us. But right now, in fact, a few years ago, Dale Jr. was complaining about some bumps that are over a tunnel that goes underneath turns one and two. And he complained to the media, which I've never understood. He never complained to me, you know. So I gave him a hard time. And he said, what would complaining to you do? I said, complaining to me, I can fix it. And he said, you can't fix bumps in asphalt. I said, oh, yes, we can. And so we improved it. You don't ever fix it, but you improve it considerably. And he came to me after the first practice session and said, I didn't think you could do that. And there's a way to do it, that little magic trick that we do. But when Tony Stewart heard it, he called and said, do not touch that racetrack. Don't. He was concerned about the surface, and he thought we were going to cut out a section right. And put a patch in or whatever. And that's a terrible thing to do. You want to try everything you can to avoid it. There are ways. I know ways to improve asphalt without cutting out a portion. And so it's a little magic trick that you got to have experience. And, you know, so we were able to do it, and Junior couldn't believe that we were able to do it. And he said, okay. Well, I said, well, see, that's why you should call me instead of calling the media. And now, if I didn't fix it, didn't have a way to fix it, didn't feel free to blast us in the media. But I think he learned a lesson there, and, you know, everything's good.
Good, good. Well, yeah, I know you guys as track presidents are always in a delicate spot, because it's a fine line between potholes at Daytona and just the right amount of track abrasion that makes for a good race. So I know those are some tough decisions that you face, and I think it's working out well so far. And I think that it's great that you took those steps to try to improve the racing after getting that driver feedback. I know that NASCAR has taken some steps this year, Eddie, to try to improve the mile and a half racing with this lower downforce package. I think the November race has had some really indelible moments at Texas the last few years, but I think it's fair to say that the spring race at night hasn't quite had as much action as the November race. What are you expecting that this package might deliver a different type of racing? What has NASCAR told you maybe to expect from the lower downforce?
Maybe the greatest race of all time here Saturday night. No.
That's a bold prediction.
You get frustrated with NASCAR because they're very slow to respond. But if I were in their shoes, I would be very studious and not make a change for the sake of making a change, but make a change because it does make things better the way they ought to be. And so that's what we're anticipating Saturday night from talking to NASCAR. Really key to all of this, of course, as it is at every track, is what kind of job Goodyear has done with the compound of the tire. We'd all love to see a tire that wears out before you run through a full tank of fuel. You know, I know the drivers are having fun and really like the low downforce package. And I think personally, from my standpoint, the racing is better. I can tell you that some of the objective standards certainly are better. You know, not subjective, but objective in terms of quality passes, lead changes under the green, things like that. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they are demonstrably better in the first six races than they were a year ago. So those kinds of things make for a better race, obviously. And, you know, that's what we're looking for Saturday night. And, you know, you applaud NASCAR for making the changes. And you know, we're looking forward to, of course, the greatest race of all time, Saturday night.
And that race, of course, will unfold over the course of 500 miles, like both of your races do annually. Because I am the objective journalist that I try to be, I admittedly have worn you out a little bit on this topic and suggested that, in my experience, when I've seen tracks go from 500 to 400 mile races, like Pocono, like Fontana, like Dover, I think it's had a demonstrable impact on the quality of the racing. So I know you disagree and would like and want to keep both your races at 500 miles and plan to do so. So I'm going to just give you the opportunity, Eddie. Make your case. Why is 500 miles the right length for your event?
Well, there is no magic to what makes a race better than another race. I can show you 400-mile races that aren't as good as there are some tracks that have a 500-mile race and a 400-mile race, you know, two races on their schedule. I could show you some that the 500-mile races are objectively, you know, everybody can say this race is good or that race is good, and every race has, just like every ball game, every race, every ball game has the opportunity, the chance to be close, you know, down to the last, you know, 8 seconds, and some crazy play happens, and, you know, Villanova wins, you know, that kind of thing. We saw earlier this week in the national championship. It also could have been a blowout, and there's nothing you can do about it, you know. And I'm not necessarily talking about that game Monday night. I'm talking about that's the nature of sports. But we've not seen anything that would indicate that 400 is a magic number that makes it better than 500. There are some cases where people would tell you that that race is better, say, you know, Pocono at 400 miles than it was at 500 miles. But there are some cases where it's not. So there's no, that doesn't mean it's magic. I just know that our fans and those people, I mean, I love the media, but the fans are the people that count, and they tell us they don't want less racing. They tell us, in fact, think about where I am. I'm in Texas, that they don't understand why we don't have a 601-mile race because
everything's better.
Everything is bigger in Texas. And I'm not saying that was just one cute comment by one person. That's a consensus is probably strong, but that is a frequent comment that we receive in some of the information that we get back from fans that we reach out and try to get their input on. So there is absolutely, absolutely, unequivocally zero interest in shortening a race here by our fans. And it doesn't matter if a media member wants it shortened or anybody else. Because the only people that matter are the fans. We all work for them, and if they weren't there, neither of us would be here. So we'll listen to the fans. Love you, Nate, but they pay my salary.
No offense taken. I appreciate the answer very much, and I'm going to give you one last opportunity here in the interest of, again, giving you equal time. I'll let you make your plug for tickets and this weekend, but I also just want to get your take also on how ticket sales maybe have been for this weekend. And there was an ISC conference call today in which there was some chatter about whether Tony Stewart and Jeff Gordon had an impact. Apparently, ISC tracks ticket sales are down about 10% in the second quarter, and they pointed to the absence of a couple of superstars who had been around for the last 15 years contributing to that. What have you seen any impact from that, Eddie, and you know, how are sales for this week?
Well, our ticket sales for this week, this Saturday night, are flat to just a hair up. I hesitate to call it up, because we're talking about such nominal numbers up that it's basically flat. But when you lose such a prominent person, like a figure like Jeff Gordon, who is definitely not racing, and Tony Stewart is hurt, that to me, being flat is a pretty strong thing to see. So, looking forward to Tony getting back. I think Tony's going to be back. I'm going to guess he'll be back by May, sometime in May. From talking to him and how he feels very good. And I have to add, his attitude is as good as it's been in years in talking with him a lot. So, Jeff is in the booth, and I think that's helpful on television, and he's doing a spectacular job there. I can remember a time, since I'm older than you, Nate, and I can remember a time that there was a great gnashing of teeth generally in our sport because we were losing over a period of just a short window of time. We were losing Pearson and Petty, and Waltrip was about to leave, and Cale Yarborough had left. And, I mean, great, great, great storied names that were really important to the sport. What are we going to do? I'll bet that we're all going to be out of business 3 years from now. You know, that kind of, and I'm overstating it there a bit, but there was a tremendous concern. And, of course, Dale Earnhardt helped bridge that gap, and then Jeff Gordon, and, I mentioned some guys, Rusty Wallace and Ernie Irvin, and, so on and so forth. And then, along came the Bushes, and so on and so forth, Tony Stewart, and so there's a constant ebb and flow of talent, and I think you would agree that there is tremendous talent in the pipeline right now. There's tremendous young talent on the racetrack, whether it's in Cup, Xfinity, or Truck, and so we're in a great place, position to go forward, and as those drivers kind of establish themselves as significant on the racetrack, their personalities tend to take off, whether they're strong personalities or, perceived as white hats or black hats. That's still to be determined by some of those young guys. Sometimes it doesn't make any sense why a guy is a black hat, but he is, and you have to have all of that to make it work. So I think we're in great shape, and I would just tell you to stand by. There's more coming, and it's our job to make a big deal out of them. So I'm not terribly concerned about the future as much as I miss Dale. As I miss Jeff Gordon in a race car, and I miss Tony in a race car.
Right. Well, certainly I agree with you. There are a lot of young personalities that are coming up that they're very interesting and have some compelling stories and have been performing as well. And among the names this weekend, Darrell Wallace Jr., Eric Jones, Chris Buescher, Chase Elliott, Ryan Blaney, all of them at Texas. And if people want to go to your fine racetrack, Eddie, and see some of them race on Friday or Saturday, is it texasmotorspeedway.com? Is that where tickets are available?
texasmotorspeedway.com is a great place to start, and you can call 817-215-8500 for tickets, or go to Ticketmaster, and they've got us there as well. But a lot of ways to get in. Or just come to the racetrack, and we're never going to turn anybody away. So never, ever, ever going to turn anybody away. And, it's spectacular at night under the lights. Again, the media doesn't like night races because of deadlines.
There are more deadlines, Eddie, because there almost are no more newspapers at this point, so I don't think you'll hear that quite as much as you once did.
But you do hear it, and it's like, okay, I can pick up my newspaper, and there's an extra inning Dodgers game that I'm going to read about in my paper, so this race going at 10 o'clock is going to be fine. So, but anyway, and I'm a former newspaper reporter, so I don't understand how it works. But no, it's, Under the Lights is special. And this is the first night race of the season, and that kind of makes everybody excited. So we're going to have a big party here. Leonard Skinner is playing the pre-race show, and we're just going to have some fun.
All right. Well, I hope that the weekend goes well for you, better than it did 20 years ago, or 19 years ago. I'm sure it will. Thanks very much for joining us on the NASCAR and NBC podcast, Eddie. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Nate.